AI New York. It's 7 a.m. and time for What's Going On with Bob Henley coming right up.
Hey, what's up, man?
Brother, what's up? This
is a
hey,
good recording, man.
Stop. Right on.
There's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying.
You know we've got to find a way
to bring some love and get here today. Picket lines and picket signs. Punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see. Oh, what's going on?
Good morning, New York and New Jersey, as well as the great world beyond. This is the Labor Press's Bob Henley at Stuck Nation, because we surely are. It's just after 7 a.m., March 28th. This is WBAI's Drive Time News Magazine, What's Going On? Paul DiRienzo is our audio engineer, and Linda Perry is our executive producer. This is your Monday morning back-to-work, back-to-school show. Sunrise was at 6:46 a.m. All this month, we've been celebrating Women's History Month and the central role women are playing in reviving the American labor movement. In New York City, it's 24 degrees. If we're lucky, our high temperature for the day will barely break freezing under partly cloudy skies. Well, that's something. Tomorrow will be brighter, but we will only get up to the mid-40s. Wednesday and Thursday, rain is in the forecast, but on Thursday, we'll get as high as the low 70s. That thermostat is stressed. Friday through Sunday, we'll settle into a less radical temperature range under partly sunny skies, hitting highs in the upper 50s all 3 days. I'm here down in Washington, D.C., covering the American Federation of Government Employees annual legislative conference. AFG represents 700,000 of this nation's federal civil servants who kept our nation running, providing vital services amidst a pandemic, an insurrection, and a government shutdown. Whether it be at their jobs in our nation's veterans' hospitals, our airports and meatpacking plants, as USDA inspectors, during the COVID crisis, these service-oriented people, all through COVID, put themselves and their families at risk to serve our nation. In way, way too many cases, they paid dearly for their commitment to us, to the communities, and to our nation. This morning, we'll be speaking with Rebecca Rondell, the AFL-CIO's National Director of Occupational Safety and Health, about keeping healthcare professionals, first responders, and other essential workers safe on the job in the age of COVID. And we'll check in with Marianne Tresciati, who is president of the Remember the Triangle Fire Coalition and director of Hofstra University's Labor Studies Program. Your calls, of course, at 212-209-2877. But first, the Pacifica Network News.
This is the Public News Service Daily Newscast, March 28, 2022. I'm Tramell Gomes. There is a general sense that the pandemic phase of COVID-19 is ending after 2 years, barring a new and more severe strain. But healing from the damage is a process. Homelessness ticked up, now affecting more than 500,000 people in the U.S., according to the World Population Review. California's State Assembly is considering extending some eviction protections for another 3 months. Their hearing is today. Suzanne Potter has the story.
The move comes as time is running out for people to apply to the Emergency Rental Assistance Program, which stops accepting applications on Thursday. Housing attorney Tina Rosales with the Western Center on Law and Poverty says people who lost their income as a result of the pandemic should apply now on housing.ca.gov.
The program will pay 100% of back rent and rent going forward for a total of 18 months. Landlords and tenants both can apply.
The eviction protections are designed to stave off a wave of homelessness because approximately 366,000 people are waiting for their applications to be processed.
Hunger insecurity also went in the wrong direction, meaning lack of access to enough healthy food. According to the Food Research and Action Center, last year, financial strain caused one in every 25 U.S. households to regularly skip meals or eat less. Paul Gaither with the Central Texas Food Bank describes the situation in Austin.
Before the pandemic, we were spending every month about $100,000 to purchase food to supplement donated food that we would get. During the pandemic, that went up to about $1 million a month, 10 times more every month. And we're not seeing that ease off.
Federal COVID relief funds that helped expand access to school meals for all kids are set to expire in June. Advocates in Colorado are urging lawmakers to make that investment permanent. Eric Galatas reports.
Ashley Whelan with Hunger Free Colorado says in addition to reducing child hunger and food insecurity, a new bill making its way through the legislature will give food producers across the state access to a reliable customer base and fair prices for their goods.
It has some funding for school districts to purchase healthy local food from our Colorado ranchers and our Colorado farmers and make sure that we're investing back into our state as we're investing in food for children.
Some critics of Senate Bill 87 argue that free meals could create government dependency. Whelan says the program can also put an end to lunch line shaming that low-income kids experience.
We've had families who testified at the committee that their child came home with a number written on their arm of what the family owed the school for school meals.
This is PNS. Advocates for small farms and ranches in North Carolina say these businesses are ready to step in and make sure people can get local, affordable meats and produce. But they need more resources. Nadia Ramlagan has more.
The USDA says shoppers will be paying 3-4% more for food this year and about 6% more to eat out. B. Ray Jeffers of the Rural Advancement Foundation International, or RAFI USA, says to reliably feed communities, small farmers need more access to processing and storage facilities and transportation options.
Anyone establishing new business has hurdles to overcome, but when you toss in unhelpful government policies, access to land crisis, unaffordable capital, and physical demanding work into the mix, a new level of challenge shows itself.
He says rising supply and equipment costs are further squeezing the ag industry.
Fertilizer has shot up. It also uses byproducts of oil refining. The International Energy Agency says if everyone adopted their 10 fuel-saving tips, it would make up for the shortage caused by boycotting Russian oil. One of the challenges of renewable energy is transmission and storage, including batteries that rely on key minerals. According to a document leaked to The Intercept, the Biden administration is considering an executive order to invoke the Defense Production Act. The act might make it easier to mine for key minerals on public lands, but some of those lands are already threatened by old energy production. Details from Roz Brown.
The American Petroleum Institute is pushing to allow more oil and gas drilling on public lands and slash regulations faced by fossil fuel firms. It comes at a time when public lands already face a loss of biodiversity with the extinction of animal and plant species due to climate change. John Leshy, who has spent much of the past 5 decades working on public lands issues, says one-third of the 550 national wildlife refuges are located along the coastlines.
And many of them are facing inundation as sea levels rise. The glaciers are disappearing from Glacier National Park. The Joshua trees and the sequoia trees are disappearing from the parks that are named after them.
Leshy is a former solicitor of the U.S. Interior Department.
Meanwhile, a bipartisan effort in Congress to curb the loss of plant and animal species could get a Senate committee vote as soon as this week. The Recovering America's Wildlife Act would invest $1.4 billion annually in state and tribal conservation efforts. Mike Leahy with the National Wildlife Federation calls it a silent crisis.
There is awareness of some of the more charismatic species out there that are in decline, but there is widespread wildlife and biodiversity declines with pollinators, aquatic species, fish, various types of birds.
This is Tremel Gomes for Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Boy, I really appreciate that cast. That's something you just don't hear anywhere else. That was comprehensive. In local news, Governor Hochul reported 7 COVID deaths for Saturday and over 800 hospitalizations. It's been under 1,000 for more than a week so far, according to the CDC's official count. We've lost over 70,000 New York State residents. There's no breakout for the deaths caused by people's occupational exposure to the virus. Yesterday, NewJersey.com reported there was 1 COVID death on Friday. The state 7-day surge for confirmed cases was 828, up 24% from a week ago, but still down 22% from a month ago. Public health experts are tracking a new variant. In Jersey, 78% of those eligible are vaccinated, but just 54% are boosted. In New York State, 83% of state residents 18 or older have been fully vaccinated, yet only 56% have gotten the booster. The New York Times reports earlier this month that there's a considerable racial disparity by race and neighborhood when it comes to getting that third dose. Last week, Mayor Eric Adams brought a new unity to the city's labor movement with his executive order that lifted the COVID vaccine mandate for out-of-town sports stars. Despite the city's firing of hundreds and hundreds of civil servants who opted not to get the vaccine, yet served for those very heavy months at the initial stages of the pandemic when there was no vaccine and basic PPE was rationed. I'm also tracking Manhattan Borough President Mark Levine's troubling report about rising evictions despite the lack of legal representation for tenants. We'll be back with AFL-CIO's Rebecca Rondell and, of course, your calls at 212-209-2877. But first, this classic from Joan Baez.
Will the circle be unbroken by and by, Lord, by and by? There's a better home awaiting in the sky, Lord, in the sky.
I will stay.
Great to have Rebecca Rondell, the AFL-CIO's Director of Occupational Safety and Health, on the line. Good morning, Rebecca.
Good morning, Bob. It's great to be here.
Well, thanks so much. I know that this is kind of early. Could you share with us your career path to studying occupational health? And did you undertake that field of study with the idea of putting it to work to advocate for working people in the labor movement? I saw you have an advanced degree in toxicology.
It's true. It's always an interesting path how people end up really fighting for justice in workplaces. I grew up in a working class union family in Cleveland, Ohio. My father worked in the steel mills. My mother held various jobs in the hospital and with the city while raising us. And I remember, you know, going with my mother to drop my dad off in the mills, a very noisy, dirty environment. And I remember him getting his safety certifications, but I didn't connect all of that until much later. So, you know, my brothers and I were first-generation college in our family, thanks to union scholarship and parents who wanted us to have an education. And I was always very interested in the sciences. So I went through college and graduate school in biology, toxicology, like you mentioned, just very interested in chemicals and exposures, and also interested in improving people's lives and social justice. So I actually served in an AmeriCorps program in college in something called the Mother Jones House, which really opened my eyes to a lot of organizing. And also what was really pivotal for me was an internship that I did in graduate school called the Occupational Health Internship Program. And it's a national program, but I was placed in New York City doing health and safety work with the New York Taxi Workers Alliance. So
it really
scored my path for the future.
Well, we were lucky to have you. While most people associate union representation with higher wages, isn't in many cases safety in the job something else that union representation can help ensure? I know from my own reporting on New York City's construction industry that union work sites are far more safer for workers and the community than non-union ones. There's a connection between the presence of a union and enhanced worker safety, isn't there?
Absolutely. A safe job is a fundamental right and a core union value. Workers and their unions are at the bargaining table with employers over safety. They're organizing for safer jobs, and they're advocating for stronger laws and protections that ensure workers ensure employers are following safe rules for workers. You can think of many pivotal moments for labor unions throughout history and associate them with major workplace safety crises. And I know we're going to talk about the Triangle Shirtwaist factory fire, also coal mine disasters. And in fact, we've actually looked at job fatality rates in states that have so-called right-to-work laws, which prevent workers from joining unions. And the rate of workplace death is 56% higher in those states with right-to-work laws than states without those laws.
Wow, that's something I don't hear widely discussed. So you mentioned the Triangle Fire. How does that fit into that, of course, that 111th anniversary was March 25th. How does that fit into the American labor movement narrative?
Sure. You know, the fire alone wasn't what made the shirtwaist makers, the employers, such a focal point for worker safety in those industrial facilities. In fact, workplace deaths weren't that uncommon at the time. But nothing would have happened if people hadn't united and made demands of their employers and of their government. They started organizing a few years before the fire, actually. And in the years leading up to the fire, the workers who were organizing they organized a general strike. And these women workers were also attacked and beaten for their efforts around organizing. And at the time of the Triangle Fire, there were few laws to protect worker safety and health or basic labor rights. So it also spurred the unions and the founding of the International Ladies Garment Workers Union. And as a result of decades of struggle by working people in unions, there are now both federal and state laws that provide basic safety and health protections. And workplaces are much safer and healthier today than they were in the early 1900s. There are fewer injuries and illnesses and deaths, but we still really do have a long way to go.
Right, as we saw with COVID, I wanted to ask you, because it's Women's History Month, and all through this month we've cataloged, with the help of women like yourself who are making this critical difference, the role of women in reviving the labor movement. And I think we have to observe, and I'd like to get your comment on the fact that the idea that this was driven by immigrant women, I guess some 20,000 women in the general strike that set up with this, what you describe as the context of the Triangle Fire, and they were largely successful. And it was even before, when women were struggling to get the vote. I mean, it seems to me that women were critical here.
Women were absolutely critical. You mentioned it was largely immigrant women and children in these factories. I mean, there were the youngest person who died in the fire was 14, a 14-year-old girl. And, you know, this was really critical. You actually had women from many different classes organizing together. This was really much larger part of the suffragist movement. But you had different classes of women who came together, who organized together, who unified around the fight for safer working conditions. It was, you know, it's a pretty incredible feat at the time. And also, just to say that the fire was one of the events that led to longer, you know, term social and labor reforms, as we know in the U.S., one of the witnesses of the fire was Frances Perkins, and she later became the Commissioner of Labor in New York State, and then also the Secretary of Labor, the U.S. Secretary of Labor under President, under FDR, under President Roosevelt.
Right.
And so the fire also led her to a lifetime of working and pushing for labor reforms and improve protections for women workers and all workers.
So if we scroll forward to our current time, we know that according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, from September to December, 17 million Americans have left their jobs. That's 5 million more than the membership of the AFL-CIO. Surveys indicate that the failure of employers to keep workers safe during the pandemic has been part of some of the motivation for what's called the Great Resignation. From your position tracking this nationally, do we really know the impact of COVID on the essential workforce? I saw the Guardian newspaper and Kaiser Health News Project report that in the first year of COVID, 3,600 U.S. healthcare workers died. Here in New York City, the city estimates 400 civil servants passed, as well as 170 MTA workers, most of them from TW Local 100. We really don't know what happened, do we, even now?
Right. The COVID-19 pandemic has been devastating to the health of workers and to their families simply because they had to go to work. One of our country's largest failures in the pandemic was that it never took the role of the workplace in an infectious disease outbreak seriously and didn't take action to protect people in those settings specifically where there, you know, is a power relationship between workers and employers. We also didn't create strong laws up front to protect workers from exposures on the job, and we never did proper surveillance to count who was getting sick, how they were getting sick, what industries they worked in, et cetera. So we actually just, you know, hot off the press a couple weeks ago, we just won language in the new law that Congress passed on funding the government for the next year. And so for the first time in the entire pandemic, the federal government will now be required to do a comprehensive national study on COVID deaths and COVID infections by occupation and industry. And throughout the pandemic, we saw a couple of these happening in states. Massachusetts did one. I think California did one. And they did quality assessments earlier in the pandemic, but the federal government hasn't made this a priority. So this is big. They have to produce this report to Congress. CDC has to produce this report to Congress within 6 months. And it will show how many workers were really affected by COVID and where those high-risk settings are that we already know, but we need this documented.
This should have been headline news. I'm sorry. I'm a voracious consumer of news and information on these issues. And you're telling me something. I mean, we did a pre-interview, and I found out about this. I mean, this is a tangible example of why it matters to have representation. What are you hearing about the impact of long COVID on workers' health?
Sure, yeah. And on that report, unions fought for it, and they won that. So, you know, really proud of that work. On long COVID, you know, we're hearing what you're hearing. People, you know, from workers, and also we're seeing from studies that they're really, the long-term effects are not insignificant. People are suffering cognitive function, fatigue, headaches, weakness in arms and legs, and you know, hair loss, dizziness. I mean, the list goes on and on. We hear all of these ailments from folks, and this is something that I think we're going to be struggling with for a really long time as a country. But workers don't have any protections to be out of work, even though they're suffering long-term effects. And you can even see that the narrative is sort of switched too. The CDC even recently switched like the metric that they're using to recommend prevention measures for folks. And they're focusing it on acute severity and hospitalization. So they're focusing on people getting sick and going to the hospital and if folks are dying. That's how we're measuring, you know, the risk in communities. We're not focusing on people contracting COVID. And that's what we need to be doing is the number of infections, who's getting sick, how we can prevent those. So we'll be dealing with these effects for a very long time. And, I, you know, think about how we're dealing with the health effects from workers exposed to the toxic dust during the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks in New York City.
Exactly.
The difference is so far is that we've normalized getting sick with COVID when it's really a much more significant issue.
Well, I think that it's very important. We'll have to have you back and monitor the progress in this. Listeners, if you have issues at work, if you have an observation about the government occupational safety in the age of pandemics, 212-209-2877, 212-209-2877. There's been a we know that particular industry and workplaces are susceptible to airborne diseases like healthcare facilities, congregate living places like nursing homes, prisons, and even meatpacking plants. Are these places safer now? I mean, more than 2 years into the pandemic, or is it very much based on the state and the locale where you were working?
Yeah, these places are still struggling. The settings that you mentioned, anywhere where people are sharing the same air, especially in indoor spaces, crowded spaces, where there's not proper ventilation, where there are not respirators available, people are getting infected with COVID, and we know it can be prevented. There's also big disparities issues. We know that many people working in those settings are people of color, and these are really high-risk environments. For instance, we were just looking at data. You know, we issue an annual report, and it'll be coming out at the end of April. It's called Death on the Job, and we hope folks will take a look at it once it comes out. But some of the data we're plowing through for that, you know, we'd look in nursing homes. Just in January and February of this year, 20% of the nursing home workforce was infected with COVID during the Omicron surge. We know it's a very high-risk environment. And what we know is that there's a situation where we could be on the cusp of another perfect storm here for the virus, right? We have a more transmissible variant coming. We have the effectiveness of vaccines waning and the talk of another booster. But we also have all these states and localities and employers who have been dropping all the prevention and mitigation measures. So, you know, we're not out of the woods.
Wow. So we do have something called OSHA, right? You know, it's been around, I guess, since the 70s. Had there been an infectious disease standard prior to the outbreak of COVID, I mean, just local, state, and federal agencies that are responsible for workplace health and safety coordinate their efforts? Or is it, like you were saying, a patchwork? I mean, it seems some states are more proactive than others. Does OSHA at least provide a floor, a minimum, in terms of a standard? I mean, I saw something move on the wire of services when President Biden came in, moving in that direction. What has Secretary Walsh done in this regard?
Right. So OSHA is the regulatory agency responsible for setting standards and enforcing in the workplace, so much under the Trump administration. And even lately, I mean, it really has, people are focused on the CDC, but OSHA is the agency that has this authority in the workplaces. And there had been an infectious disease standard under President Obama. But that work had been stalled under the Trump administration. And so only after immense pressure from the labor movement last summer did OSHA finally issue emergency protections against COVID for healthcare workers. They issued an emergency standard. And we tried to get them to issue protections for all high-risk workplace settings. You know, basic common sense measures like ventilation, providing respirators, ensuring that workers are notified when they've been exposed to COVID on the job, ensuring there's paid leave when workers become infected with COVID, anti-retaliation rules so people can speak up without retaliation about their unsafe working conditions, and training. So we did this. Emergency protections expire this winter. We're fighting to make those permanent. There's actually a hearing in a couple weeks that we'll be testifying in. And so, you know, people, we're going to be dealing with COVID in these high-risk settings like workplaces for a long time. And there has been some action, but, you know, the work is not over.
No, and it's certainly not. And you mentioned the different states' efforts. In New York State, Albany has enacted the New York Hero Act. It was a top priority of the New York State AFL-CIO, and it was designed to ensure that essential workers had proper PPE and ventilation, as well as whistleblower protections like you were referring to, so in case their employer retaliated if they complained about dangerous conditions in the workplace. We spoke about this law specifically last week. What are your thoughts about it? California, as you say, has also weighed in to keep workers safe in the pandemic. Do we also, I guess, this the federal government has to, it all has to happen at the same time to be effective?
Right. The federal government would certainly set the floor and set a baseline for what everybody has to follow across the country. States can go beyond that if they want. And in the absence of the federal government taking action, the New York Hero Law was really an incredible effort by a large unified coalition that's helped make the New York Hero a reality to protect workers in New York State. And that was when the federal government wasn't acting. So, and it's still really important today. And this covers private sector employers. They have to establish a plan. I'm sure you went over this before with folks. But it's big, but it's not just about COVID. It's also about airborne infectious agents across the board so that if we have another one, it doesn't have to be COVID specific. And there are very important requirements in this that mirror what we fight for at the federal level. All the things I mentioned about having a plan and PPE at no cost to workers, anti-retaliation, having training. And so a huge success of the New York Hero is also the requirement for employers to have health and safety committees. Right. And these are co-chaired and co-staffed with non-supervisory workers. This is huge. Those workers have to be chosen by the workforce and their representatives, not by the boss. They have to meet within certain time periods, and employers have to respond to health and safety concerns in writing. There are a couple issues with the law that haven't been ironed out yet in practice. The plan has to be triggered by the Commissioner of Health. So we need to make sure that we elect leaders who will put good people in those positions. And there's also some unclear enforcement mechanisms. So it's not entirely clear how they're going to enforce. And so when a law is passed, the work doesn't stop there. Those coalitions are continuing to push and remedy those changes. And we just have a lot of work to do to make it real.
One thing that just triggered me, so what you're saying is that these workers' safety committees, this is for work environments where there is not a union. As we know, sadly, 10% of workplaces are union. It's like a third of public workplaces. But so this is really, this is a radical notion that people have the courage to follow through, is it not?
No, that's right. That's right. If two or more workers request of the employer that they have a health and safety committee, they're supposed to do it under this law. And that is with or without a union in private sector workplaces. What we need to make sure the state will do is to back up those workers when they do that and not let employers retaliate against them for trying to form these committees, right? So this is why the government support behind this law is so critical.
So if people want to get in touch with you and make sure that they are up on the latest, how would they do that? Give us your essential coordinates.
Sure. You can go to the AFL-CIO's webpage. We also have a Twitter account. We have a Facebook account. You can find us all over social media. We'll be in the news, I think, a lot in the coming weeks. Workers' Memorial Day is April 28th, and workers and their unions all around the country will be organizing around that. So stay tuned and feel free to get in touch.
Thank you so much for taking the time. That's Rebecca Brendel, AFL-CIO, Director of Occupational Safety and Health. This old standard from Pete Seeger, solidarity forever. We'll be back.
Shall run. There can be no power greater anywhere beneath the sun. Yet what force on earth is weaker than the feeble strength of one? But the union makes us strong.
Solidarity forever.
Labor medley. I am so pleased to have Marianne Trasciati on the line this morning. She's president of the Remember the Triangle Fire Coalition and director of Hofstra University's Labor Studies Program, and has a new exciting anthology out, Talking to the Girls, intimate and political essays on the Triangle Fire, co-edited with her colleague, Advija Hunza. So, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing very well. Thank you so much for having me.
So we've dedicated this whole month to women and the labor movement. How did you decide to study and teach labor studies? What was your path?
That's a great question. Well, some of it is intellectual. As a student, particularly a graduate student, I found myself increasingly drawn to stories about, and books and things about working people, about people who really were at the heart and soul of the struggle to make a better world here in the U.S. and everywhere else around the world. And also my personal story. I'm a child of the working class. My dad was a mechanic at Pan American. He was a transport workers union member, and his family and my mother's family, the men were all coal miners in the United Miners. And the women were garment workers in the International Ladies Garment Workers Union, including my mom. So it's kind of overdetermined, I guess you would say.
So in addition to working Hofstra, you're president of Remembering the Triangle Fire Coalition. What can you tell us about that coalition?
Oh, it's an extraordinary organization. The coalition was founded in 2008, and it's a public arts, an arts activist, public memory, public history organization of volunteers who are committed to bringing the story of the Triangle Fire to individuals and organizations around New York, the U.S., and the world. And we help organize the annual commemoration every year, which we just did this year virtually. And we are aiming now to build a memorial to the Triangle Fire on the Brown Building, which used to be the Ash Building, and that's where the fire happened. So just a bunch of volunteers with a lot of different skills and a whole lot of moxie.
So tell us about this just-released anthology, Talking to the Girls, Intimate and Political Essays on the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire, published by New Village Press. What inspired it?
Well, so I've been working with Remember the Triangle Fire Coalition for a number of years, and also so I'm deeply committed to, because my mom was a garment worker, and she told me when she was younger that when I was younger that she knew that she was safe in her factory because of what had happened to the poor girls at Triangle. So that, and I learned about the fire in school. So I was drawn to Remember the Triangle Fire Coalition and to activism around the Triangle Fire and workers' rights and workplace safety because of my family history and my intellectual interests. But I'm also Italian American, and I met up with when I moved back to New York after graduate school, met up with a really great group of women doing work in Italian American studies and not just a bunch of Italian American artists, writers, activists, intellectuals, and one of them was Advice Giunta, and we became friends and found each other at various Triangle Fire commemorations, including one that we held in 2001. It was the first Italian-American Triangle Fire commemoration. And over the years, we just became convinced that the work that people do around Triangle is deeply political, but it's also deeply personal, deeply intimate. If people have, their connection to the story of Triangle is both, public, but also deeply personal, and we wanted to explore that, and we thought that an anthology of essays would be the best way to do that, and so that's basically what we did.
Callers, I want to remind you, you can get in this conversation, 212-209-2877, 212-209-2877. So what did you learn that you didn't know through the process of pulling together this anthology? I mean, you've studied this, so it must have given you some insights. Share with us, what were those?
Well, some of them have to do with actually the way the book works. This is a book that relies on a lot of scholarly sources, including probably the most important is the archives at Cornell University, the Kiel Center Archives. Anyone who's interested in the Triangle Fire, Google Triangle Fire and Kiel, K-H-E-E-L, and you'll find a wealth of information on their oral histories, newspaper accounts, testimony, and just all images, all kinds of things. But although it's born of this kind of historical work, we asked our contributors not to do scholarly things, particularly those who were academics, to write from the heart. Tell us a story. Tell us your story about Triangle. And I think one of the things that really surprised me was how really challenging this was for our contributors, who range from, Annalise Orlick, who's a labor historian, Annie Lynn Zalotto, who is a performance artist and activist, Ellen Todd, who is an art historian, so we've got activists and historians and art historians, and they struggled to move from the you know, to connect many of them, the personal and the political. And so that was interesting to me to see how we feel these things, we do these things, but sometimes it's hard to talk about how they're related. And I guess the other thing is, I don't know if this surprised me, but it kind of confirmed what I knew, which is that the story of Triangle is a story that has incredible power to move people, to unite people, and to really inspire them to work as the workers and the politicians did after the fire, to work to make the world a better place. And well, I was just reminded of that.
Yeah, we have some callers on the line. There are stockholders here at WBAI. Caller, where are you calling from? What's your name and what's on your mind?
Hey, it's Russ up in White Plains, Bob.
Yes, sir.
Bob?
Yes.
Don't be afraid, Bob. Hey, I'd like to ask your guest, you know, speaking of the personal, Francis Perkins was the person who FDR stole the credit from for all the labor history and labor advancements. And I always get upset when people don't mention that Francis Perkins witnessed that and converted that tragedy to real improvements, not just parading around. And I would have asked your previous guest if the perception about the pandemic has affected teacher labor unions and the perception that they do things at the expense of our children. But I'd like to hear your guest talk about Francis Perkins. Thanks.
Rob from White Plains? Is that
Russell.
Your name?
Yes.
Russell from
yes.
White Plains. Russell, that's an excellent question. We actually have an essay in the book by Tomlin Perkins Coggeshall, who is Francis Perkins' only grandchild, her grandson. And he talks about, the book actually opens with a story of him with his grandmother in her house eating arrowroot biscuits and a ladder that's outside a rope ladder that is used to kind of do homemade fire drills, and how her having witnessed the Triangle Fire profoundly changed her life and influenced her family as well. And you're absolutely right. Perkins, you know, she said quite famously now on the 50th anniversary of the fire that the New Deal began on March 25th, 1911. She was a young social worker. She saw it. I'm thrilled to announce that New York City named a street after her, the street where she lived. I can't remember the intersection. I'm so sorry, but it's the street where she lived when she was a young social worker, where the settlement house is that she worked at. So she is, I think, increasingly getting her due, and rightly so, because she really was important.
Well, it's funny because in the prior city council administration, or Cory Booker, as you know, City Hall is filled with large, overbearing oil paintings of great white men in the radio room. I have to look at Henry Clay. And yet what they did was on the way down to the basement of the city council press office, they have little pictures of black and whites of 20th century heroines like Dorothy Day and Perkins, of course. We have some callers on the line. Turns out you're popular. Caller, where are you calling from? What's on your mind? What's your name?
Daryl McPherson, Bronx, New York, and thank you so much, Bob, for having excellent guests.
So what's going on? What do you think?
What I want to know is the coalition a 501c3? And would you repeat
yes.
the guest's information, her last name again? Well, Professor, what I really want to know is, do you all need money in order to run the coalition?
Well, that's a straightforward question. Thanks so
and
much
I
for
love
that
it.
Important question.
Okay, what I'm offering you is WBAI is a member of a platform called Good Shop, and on that platform is a search engine called Good Search. If you could get the members of the coalition to put in BAI as their charity of choice after they register with Good Shop and use Good Search, which requires no out-of-pocket money, rather than doing what you said, go to Google, go to Good Search, and your organization can get a penny a search.
Well, that's great. That's some behind-the-scenes information. And thanks again for calling, Daryl. So I think it's a good opportunity. Our listeners have good insights. To reiterate that appeal so folks can contribute.
Yeah, thank you so much for that information. I'm definitely going to check it out, and we do need money. We are, as I mentioned, building a memorial
to the 146 mostly immigrant women, young women as young as 14 years old, from mostly Italian and Jewish. And it will be New York's first labor memorial. And that is not, I did not misspeak. New York City, which bills itself as a union town, does not have a labor memorial. It will be one of a small number of memorials that speak to women's struggles and women's concerns. And because the text that tells the story of the Triangle Fire that will be on the memorial will be translated into Italian and Yiddish, as well as in English, it will be our first trilingual memorial. And we do need money. We're hoping to dedicate that memorial on the next anniversary of the Triangle Fire, March 25th, 2023. If you would like to see images of the memorial, it's a beautiful design that we chose through an international competition. Go to rememberthetrianglefire.org, and you can see information about the coalition, but also images of this memorial, and it gives you a place where you can donate. We are a registered 501c3 in the state of New York, so your donations would be taxed deductible, and you will be recognized as a donor when we dedicate the memorial.
I mean, one of the things is that I also, I guess this year you had a very poignant virtual observation of this anniversary. I suggest people, I'll make sure to tweet that out, a link to that today. We have another caller on the line. Caller, what's your name? What's on your mind?
Hi, Eric the Red, Bronx, as the great Karl Marx points out, the capitalists will be their own grave diggers. Let's make the revolution now. Quote, let the ruling classes tremble at a communist revolution. The proletarians have nothing to lose but their chains. They have a world to win. Working men of all countries, unite! Power to the people. Thanks. Bye.
Thank you. Thank you for that enthusiastic call. We have another caller online. Where are you calling from? What's your name? What's on your mind?
Hello. Hi. Good morning.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning. Well, yeah, I want to ask a question, but with that previous caller, I would disagree with everything he just said.
Fair enough.
I don't believe in that nonsense at all. However, in my question, okay, was the fire on many floors or just one floor? And when the ladies jumped to their death from that room, is that room still, can that be seen? Is it used in any way in the modern day at all, like the way the building is now? I'm just wondering.
Thanks.
Great questions. The Brown Building used to be called the Ash Building, ironically, and it's a 10-story neo-Renaissance building one block east of Washington Square Park. The Triangle Waist Company, because shirt waist, those kind of crisp women's blouses used to be called waists. The Triangle Shirtwaist Company, or the Triangle Waist Company, was on the 8th, 9th, and 10th floors. The fire started on the 8th floor. Switchboard operator called up to the 10th floor where most of the, what we would call management, the owners and their families were. 8th floor workers got out for the most part. 10th floor workers went across the roof and were ferried to safety by NYU students in the building next door. And the 9th floor workers are the ones who suffered the terrible tragedy the worst. Over 50 women jumped from the 9th floor, and there were nets there to catch them, but they broke through the nets. The fire ladders only reached up to the 6th floor, so they couldn't climb down. And the building was fireproof. Its contents, especially the people, were not. So it does still stand. And it is now an NYU science building. There are labs in there. And I can tell you, having gone up to the 9th floor for previous Triangle commemorations, it's a really eerie feeling to go and see the students huddled over their lab tables, kind of reminiscent of women huddled over sewing tables, and then to stand and look out the windows of the 9th floor. How absolutely terrified those girls must have been of the fire to choose to jump from the 9th floor rather than, await their fate inside the building. Just awful.
So thank you for those questions. One of the things is that I'm thinking that 2001, you had the commemoration, the Triangle Fire. It's not lost to me also that just across the island of Manhattan with what happened with the 9/11 World Trade Center, attack and then the 7 months of cleanup. At the time the EPA said the air was safe to breathe, we know now that more people have died from the occupational exposure to the toxins in the air. The World Trade Center program has tens of thousands of people that are dealing with very serious diagnoses. I've noticed through the years, going to these events, that's why I miss the ones that are in person, that the coalition has very successfully told the story about workers and the way that market forces can sometimes make them expendable. I remember that you also use the occasion of a commemoration to highlight undocumented construction workers. Can you talk about that, how the role of keeping this tragic day relevant and as a tool to move us forward, to make workplaces safer for everyone?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Thank you so much. I think about the song that I heard when I was waiting to come on live, Solidarity Forever. That's really what it's all about, right? That's the core value of the labor movement, and that's what we attempt to do with the coalition. The story of Triangle is a story of 111 years ago. People were considered expendable, particularly immigrant women. And they lost their lives through corporate greed and a city that really didn't care to regulate safety so that working people could flourish on the job rather than and wages could flourish on the job rather than be, you know, eat slowly, chewed to death by the machines of capitalism. But that still happens. We know that, right? We know that garment workers die around the world, and we know that workers struggle in the U.S. for safe workplaces. Triangle was the largest workplace disaster in New York before 9/11, so there is an intimate connection between the two. And we see the commemoration as an opportunity to honor those who died and respectfully, work with their families, the people who are descendants or, relatives of Triangle workers. But it's also about the labor movement writ large, right, and the continuing struggle for worker power, workplace safety. And I will add this, even the Starbucks organizing campaign is related to Triangle because Starbucks Workers United, SEIU is the union that used to be the International Ladies Garment Workers Union, and that's the union that Triangle workers fought to join unsuccessfully. And so even coffee, baristas can claim a legacy of the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire. It really belongs to every worker everywhere who is fighting for workplace democracy, worker rights, and workplace safety.
So one of the things, though, I'm just wondering, I am surprised that in the decades I've been doing this work, how many people in unions are not aware of the Triangle incident? Are you surprised by that when you speak with people?
Yes and no. I mean, we don't. For another project I'm working on, I did some research with a colleague about labor education in public schools, and what are the opportunities people have to learn about Triangle? And it's pretty bleak when you look at it out there. I mean, we need to do a lot better to push state legislatures to mandate labor education in the schools. We need to do a lot better at getting historic sites like the Brown Building where the Triangle Fire happened recognized and get them to speak, to tell their stories to people who walk by. We need to do what you're doing and get labor stories out there in the media. I mean, it's not an accident that this history isn't taught, but we need to push back against that. I poll my students. I teach at Hofstra University. I poll my students regularly and ask them to name labor leaders, and they can't. And then I ask them to name businessmen, and they can. And, we got to change that. And part of what we're doing with the book, with talking to the girls, is, the stories that are in that book are so powerful and so readable and so shareable that this is, this is part of our contribution to changing this abysmal situation. And we're just trying to make labor history relevant and engaging. And I think we do it with the book and with the coalition. And I think you do it. And I think we need more of us to do this work.
Oh, you're an inspiration. What are the coordinates to get in touch with you?
To get in touch with me, with me?
Yeah, the Triangle, the coalition.
You can Google rememberthetrianglefire.org, and that's our website. Triangle Fire Coalition on Facebook. We Triangle Coalition on Instagram. You can email me at Hofstra University, Marianne Trasciatti, Marianne.Trasciatti@hofstra.edu. I apologize for my last name, but it's the one I got. It's hard to say and spell, but that's it. So, and get in touch with me, and I will happily connect you with activities that we're doing in the coalition. Yeah, and check out the book. If you Google NYU Press and Talking to the Girls, you'll find the book, and it's really wonderful. I think everybody should read it.
Maybe we'll have you and your co-editor on when it's closer to Worker Memorial Day. Thank you so much, Marianne Trasciatti of the Remember the Triangle Coalition. Frenchie Davis in the space tomorrow. Democracy Now! Is up next. Stay strong and make trouble wherever you find yourself.
You're tuned to listener sponsor WBAI New York with a moment in women's history.
What I'm curious to see, do the Constitution of the United States mean anything?
Fannie Lou Hamer was one of the most influential and powerful voices of the civil and voting rights movements. Born in 1917, Hamer grew up in poverty in the Mississippi Delta region, picked cotton starting when she was 6 years old. She underwent involuntary sterilization in 61, a common practice at the time to reduce the black population. She didn't know she had the right to vote until 1962 at a SNCC, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee meeting. And then she became an organizer in voter registration drives.
We are a part of America because we didn't come here on our own. Our parents and our descendants was from Africa, and we didn't come on our own, but we do want to be treated as human beings. And I'm fighting for human right, not for equal right.
In 1963, Fannie Lou Hamer was arrested at a sit-in protesting whites-only seating at a bus station. There she was severely beaten, resulting in lifelong injuries. By 64, she helped organize Freedom Summer and took part in organizing the Freedom Democratic Party and fought to run for Congress, challenging the local Democratic Party's efforts to block black participation.
We knew from the beginning that we wouldn't be seated, but we wanted to explain our side, whereas in a state that 42% of the people can't register, they wasn't representing us. And I think somebody, it's time now for somebody to be in Congress that's going to represent the people of Mississippi. And we wasn't allowed to go inside, but that didn't stop the challenge.
By 1968, Hamer's vision.
And you're listening to WBAI New York. It's coming on to 8 a.m. and time for Democracy Now!